This is True North Story, the original podcast series. Learn, love, listen, live. Are you ready to discover your True North Story with your hosts, Tama Fulton and John Hudson Masserol?
Our guest today is Michael Medved, a radio show host, author, political commentator, and film critic. His talk show is nationally syndicated, and you can find out more about him at michaelmedved.com.
Well, I know you had taken a little bit of a hiatus with a personal illness battle that you've come back from, and now you're back on the air. And so tell us how you're feeling and how things are going.
I'm doing wonderfully. I mean, I am cancer-free, thank God. And what's amazing is that when I think back on it, it's still less than a year since I got my diagnosis. So I've gone through this whole chemotherapy and radiation treatment and all of it, and now back to work. I mean, I've sort of resumed a very full schedule. In fact, I was just in Alaska, actually, on Thursday of last week. So I'm feeling great. And, you know, thank God my hair is back. And the interesting thing is it's curlier and darker.
You know, that's what I hear. After chemo, it sometimes changes.
Yes, and it does. I mean, it's shockingly and wonderfully less gray. And I haven't been able to achieve the level of vanity to color my hair or anything like that. But my wife, who same thing, has never colored her hair and doesn't have any scraps of gray, is actually grateful that we've had this natural, but if cancer induced, darkening of my hair.
Well, Michael, what gets you out of bed these days?
I love my work, and I was just talking about it with my wife actually last night. It's obviously, I think people often with our saturation media have the sense that we're living through history, but because of my work and being able to broadcast 3 hours every day, I feel as if I'm part of the conversation. Cliche is that journalism is the first draft of history, but in today's world, it's not separate from the ongoing river of events. You're paddling in it.
Loving your work is definitely important, and I know that you do. Can I switch gears for just a second and ask you about, well, it's partly to do with your work. It's reviewing movies. You've been doing that for a long, long time. What is it?
1980.
Wow. What is it about movies, Michael, that captivates you and keeps you wanting to go and see more and talk about more?
Not much, to tell you the truth. Again, I have confessed very freely in my book, Right Turns, and frequently in interviews that, unlike a lot of other people who have made a living reviewing and talking about film, I never grew up as some kind of movie nerd.
Uh-huh.
In other words, there are people who do that work who just adore film and will take every chance to watch film, and I find it tedious and increasingly onerous. But then again, I found it onerous 20 years ago. I in Hollywood versus America, my book, which came out in 1992, I said that being a film critic in 1992 is like being a glorified sewer inspector. Now, I see and review about two movies a week, sometimes only one. The answer is because I think it is a window on popular culture. And motion pictures are not a profound influence on our society the way they used to be, but they are a profound influence on the rest of the entertainment industry, which is in turn through television in particular, and now increasingly through various internet-accessed media, which is a profound influence on our society. In other words, I think motion pictures are sort of one removed from influence. Look, I am proud to be a curmudgeon, and we've raised our three kids, and my wife and I have, we're about to have our 31st anniversary.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And, well, she survived. I think the cancer was probably harder for her than it was for me.
Just to see your loved one go through that, I'm sure.
Well, it's also, I mean, you know, all of a sudden, sort of the basic stuff that you count on your partner to do, at least for a couple of weeks.
Right.
I was 11 weeks off work, which was very hard for me. I had had every intention to work through throat cancer on the radio, and I kept trying to come back when my voice wasn't right. But in any event, we appear to be through that, at least for the time being. But the point that I was going to make was my wife and I have lived that entire time period without television, without cable. So that, for instance, that there was just a study, and it's a medically accredited study, that the average teenager between the ages of 14 and 19 now spends 9 hours a day, 9 hours a day, no kidding,
wow,
in front of screens, television, computer, you know, obviously iPhone screens. And that doesn't include, by the way, that doesn't include messaging, texting. It includes consuming some form of game or entertainment or something. And it's just a staggering amount of time.
That's a lot of intake and not a lot of output.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's exactly the point. I mean, and even the output put that you're called upon to give on screens tends not to be meaningful. And that's why, I mean, I know that you had asked about True North. You know, obviously, I thought about that. I think that the sense in which people use the term True North has to do with reorientation, setting your compass.
Exactly.
And for me, the essential element of that is the Sabbath. And it's something that I think that when you begin talking about it to people, they can have a better understanding of why the Sabbath is sufficiently important that the Bible would include it as one of the Ten Commandments. In other words, here you have the Ten Commandments, which are pretty basic stuff. Don't steal, don't murder, don't bear false witness, basic stuff. And then, boom, here's this commandment that seems out of left field: honor the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Why is the Sabbath so important? And the answer is that the Sabbath is a crucial instrument in Judeo-Christian tradition for reorienting your perspective.
It's a reset, isn't it?
Exactly. In other words, and what the purpose of the Sabbath is to emphasize the huge gap between the urgent and the important. In other words, we live our lives, particularly today, under the tyranny of the urgent. There are always urgent deadlines. I mean, in radio, that's the nature of it. You're coming up to the to the hard break.
The hard stop, that's right.
Right, and you can be in the middle of the world's most eloquent and expressive sentence, but forget it. Time's up. And basically, the Sabbath tells you that what is urgent is not important, and what is important is not necessarily urgent. In other words, it's such a refreshing experience. And again, I think, frankly, it should be easy to sell for people. And it's 25 hours a week. It's not 24. When I've had this situation where I've talked in interviews before, too stupid to know that there are 24 hours in a day. But but in actuality, the Sabbath comes in at sundown.
Sundown. That's right.
And it goes out only at full dark. Traditionally, you're supposed to be able to see three stars. And in places like Seattle, where there are only a couple of nights a year where you can actually see stars because of the cloud cover, the time is calculated, but it's calculated as full dark. So it gives you 25 hours a week, and part of the reason for that is you're supposed to be reluctant to see the Sabbath go, which is generally the case, because if you can imagine, okay, here 25 hours a week where you're not going to pick up the telephone, and you're not going to pick up your email, and you're not going to get any text messages, and you're not going to turn on the radio, and you're not going to turn on the TV if you have a TV, and you're not going to get in your car. So what the heck do? Well, you talk to the people who mean the most to you.
Yes.
And then for those who are so inclined, you pray or you read or you play board games. It's basically the Mormons, our Mormon friends, have a thing called family night, which I believe now is Wednesday night in the LDS Church. Family night, people don't schedule anything else, and you're supposed to be home together. And by the way, it is true. I'd like to say that we were one of those exemplary families, and I know they exist, but it's not us, where people sit down to a formal meal every night. And that sounds like a wonderful idea. With my life and with screenings and speeches and busy career and my wife's life and basically the lives of our children, that was impossible.
Mm.
But the Sabbath makes it not just possible, but mandatory. Not only one night a week, but the big meal on the Sabbath usually is midday on Saturday. And we tend to have guests. We have very interesting guests from inside our congregation and people who are Jewish and not Jewish and Christian and secular. And we've even had on a couple of occasions, we've had Muslim guests for the Sabbath. And it's a pleasure. And again, It reminds you what counts, and part of what counts is gratitude, which is one of the first things you say on the Sabbath is you recite, and this is traditional for Jewish families around the world, you recite the 31st chapter of the book of Proverbs, which is usually translated as a woman of valor. It's about a page and a half. It's not long. It's honoring the woman of the household who traditionally has helped to make the Sabbath possible with
all the preparations.
Household. Yeah, and the way I've heard it described, and this is not original with me, is it's like I have a friend who's a rabbi whose real love in life, aside from Judaism, is sailing. And at one time, he was in the business of building sailboats. And he talks about the Sabbath as it's like going on a long sailing voyage. Is you have to figure, you have to get everything ready for your trip before you leave.
Right.
But once you've left the dock, it's too late. You can't go back and get other stuff. So basically, you're preparing yourself for this journey into time. And again, this is something that Rabbi Heschel said very famously. He wrote a book on the Sabbath in the 1950s, which was very influential. Rabbi Heschel, which is H-E-S-C-H-L, said that people have always built palaces in space. And Jews have built a palace in time, meaning creating all of these decorations and elaborations and special niches and then grand palazzos and the rest of it for the Sabbath, filled with smaller traditions that are actually pretty widely honored around the Jewish world.
This is True North Story, the original podcast series. Learn, love, listen, live. Now, back to the program.
Well, And talking about True North, I love the idea of your friend and sailing, because not only do you have to be prepared, but you have to know where you're going.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have some sort of guide, whether it's a compass or, as the older sailors use, the stars in the sky to help them and direct them and lead them to where their destination was. And
right. My friend, who's fairly well known and controversial, of course, whose name is Rabbi Daniel Lappin. I remember we knew each other when he now has, he has 7 children and I think 16 grandchildren so far. And but when he only had 3 kids and they were little, he and his wife decided to sail from California to Hawaii.
Wow.
Which is a substantial undertaking with 3 little kids. I think they were all below the age of 5. And one of the things that happened was their electricity gave out. Their electronic instruments and radio and all that stopped working about 2 days into the... So basically, the lives of his children are dependent upon him using the very old-fashioned navigation to find the Hawaiian Islands. And if you don't find the Hawaiian Islands, if you're off even a little bit, you're in the middle of open ocean and you're in trouble. In any event, they made it to Honolulu.
Well, I'm so glad they were able to get their bearings and know their direction.
Right. Otherwise, those 16 grandchildren don't exist. But
that's right. And, you know, that's so true of all of us. If we don't have a grounding force, we are off direction just a bit. Our lives can be altered tremendously. I know in your book, Right Turns, you made some pretty drastic changes to your ideologies and so forth. What do you think was the catalyst to that change? And I'll end on that, Michael.
Sure. One other thing about the Sabbath, and
yes,
I'll come back to that, which is that on Friday night, and this is before you bless the wine and before you say the blessing on bread, you recite the Eshet Chayil, which is the woman of valor. And then the next thing that you do is you bless the children. And again, it's in all prayer books. And you say a blessing on each of your children, and literally, physically, often it will be the father and the mother will put hands on the head of the children and ask for God's protection and blessing on them, which is a very, very important thing. I remember very, very fondly, when I was growing up, my parents weren't religious. My father became religious later in life. And I remember my late father, who passed away on March 11th, 2009. I remember my father blessing me, and how important that is, because, again, I think it motivates every child to try to be a blessing to the parents. And aside from reminding the parent about how important and how grateful you are for that child, who in many cases can be part of your Sabbath celebration. One of the interesting things is I know that in terms of the other question about what sort of put me on a different path toward True North, I know that it's much more fashionable and dramatic to talk about these very dramatic transitions from being hard left to being hard right. My friend David Horowitz, who really grew up in a commie home, and talks about it, and then was very much involved with the New Left and Ramparts magazine, and now is very much on the hard right. I'm kind of disappointing in that regard, because I was a moderate leftist. I mean, the furthest left I ever got was working for the Robert Kennedy presidential campaign, which frankly isn't very far left. I mean, I'm not at all sure that Robert Kennedy or John Kennedy would have been a Democrat in today's world.
Interesting.
So, by the way, and I don't consider myself part of the, quote, hard right. For instance, I am unabashedly pro-immigration, and it's an issue in which I think that a number of Republicans are behaving with all the suicidal intensity of lemmings. And so, in other words, I think I've always had a temperament that was contrarian, and... I was sort of contrarian when I was on the left, and I'm something of a contrarian on the right. But I think that comes to the now, finally, after that long prelude, an answer to your question, which is that in my book I talk about the 3 P's, which I think are responsible for moving a lot of people from the left to at least the center, if not the right. And the three P's being parenthood, paychecks, and prayer. And it's one of those things when you talk about parenthood, the percentage of votes for Mitt Romney, just to take one example, of parents with children at home was overwhelming. Overwhelming. It was over 60%. The percentage of married women, Romney won married women by 8 points.
Interesting.
And again, I think that becoming a parent, the whole process of becoming a parent, particularly if you've waited till relatively late in life, as many of us do, my wife and I did, and then it wasn't easy for us, initially at least, to have children. Our first pregnancy ended in a miscarriage, which was terrifying and traumatizing. Mm. That entire experience moves you in a more conservative direction. And then paychecks, and it's so funny, I was just seeing this with my daughter, is that it's all fine. Taxes are usually an abstraction, and you don't understand why the old man is so annoyed with taxes. And then all of a sudden you get your paycheck. Well, wait a minute. I was supposed to be getting $1,000 here. What happened to all that money?
Yes.
And it is kind of hard to explain. And that when I started, because when I was working in politics right after law school, I was never in the kind of job where you got a W-2 or where they took taxes out.
Sure.
And in fact, one of the jobs that I held in politics for a sitting U.S. congressman, I was working in his campaign, not his congressional office, and so I would be paid in cash, which would be delivered in paper bags.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so again, taxes are not a concern. All of a sudden, when I started getting regular paychecks, you start noticing, and that, I think, moves you to the right. And then when I mentioned prayer, I started becoming religiously involved in my early 20s, and increasingly so. And then, of course, you get more religiously involved when you marry and start building a family. I think that's quite normal, and that certainly has moved me in a more conservative direction. I would argue that despite the proliferation of prominent people who are Jewish, who are on the left, the Judaism itself is profoundly conservative. Two ways. Number one, because the most fundamental of all Jewish instincts is to replicate in your own life patterns of behavior that are associated with your parents and grandparents and great-grandparents.
Beautiful tradition, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is true of Reform Jews, conservative Jews, Orthodox Jews, all Jews. It's partially trying to honor the past. Now, that's a conservative instinct. And then the other aspect that I believe is much more comfortably fits much more comfortably with a rightist orientation as opposed to a leftist orientation is the idea of absolutes, that there is such a thing as a right and wrong. And again, I think that right now in reaction to Paris, it's one of the reasons that, I mean, I think that this is very politically significant because it reminds people that there is such a thing as evil in the world, not just people who are misguided or aggrieved, but who have actually committed themselves to a profoundly evil ideology.
The absence of good.
Not just the absence of good. I mean, the absence of good, you know, most people live with an absence. Well, I wouldn't say most people live with an absence of good, because there are good deeds and good things that people do all the time. What we're talking about is not the absence of good or the absence even of some kind of orderly or positive ideology. We're talking about the embrace of monstrous evil. In other words, the idea that you would cry out, Allahu Akbar, that God is great, at the moment that you're blowing yourself into bloody little chunks of flesh for the sake of murdering innocent children and old people, the idea that this is a religious act is so profoundly demented as to be diabolical and evil. Look, I think that Stalinists and Nazis and jihadists are all not simply misguided, not simply lacking in goodness, embracing murderous and evil ideologies. What I think about is some of what has been going on in Israel is what it means that someone can believe that it is somehow a virtuous act, approach someone on the street who you don't know, and at very close range, because you have to be close, to plunge a knife into somebody's body, and the sense that this is a religiously blessed action is so alien to any aspects of the Jewish or Christian traditions. And by the way, I think it's also deeply alien to authentic Islam. But it's one of those things as a recognition that this is not just, that there is no moral relativism. In other words, that was certainly one of those things that moved me in a more conservative direction, was particularly at the time that South Vietnam fell, and which was April and May of 1975. And there were horrendous massacres, not just in Cambodia, but in Vietnam, where there were 1 million people who were put in re-education camps. There were 120,000 people who drowned in little boats trying to get out of Vietnam. When all of that happened, the notion that this is just, who are we to criticize because there were terrible things that were done to Native Americans, the purposeful liquidation of whole populations has never occurred in the United States. And this, by the way, this is part of my 10 big lies about America, is most of the tragic death of Native populations in North America occurred because of disease, the overwhelming majority. And it was not because of smallpox blankets, because people did not understand germ theory at the time, even if they had wanted to do that, and they didn't.
Thank you so much for your time.
You're
Thank
very
you
welcome.
For helping to guide us by telling us about Sabbath, gratitude, prayer, understanding right and wrong, all good things to guide us.
Well, thank you. It's good for you in doing a series like this, and I will look forward to it, and I'm very glad to speak with you.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Tama. All best. Have a great week.
Suddenly, a voice told me, keep on singing, little boy, and raise your arms to the big black sky. Raise your arms the highest you can, so the whole universe will glow.
Thank you for listening to True North Story, the series. Follow us on Twitter @TrueNorthStory and tune in next time for another True North Story.